And that brings me to my first speaker. We'll have two speakers tonight, and it's customary for the roundup that the Friday night speakers are from Thailand or here in Thailand. And the first speaker is Jay, and I've known Jay 3 years. And, you know, he lives in Thailand. He came to Thailand 17 years ago. And he lives with his lovely wife, Poom, and their daughters, the two beautiful daughters. And, you know, he's the kind of guy in AA, you learn that there's those that show us what to do and those that show us what not to do. And Jay is the guy that I look up to because he shows me what to do and how I can stay sober on a daily basis. So with that, I will give you Jay.
I'm Jay, I'm an alcoholic. Guido, he just came and he asked me to pause a lot and to speak slowly because there's a translator, and I was also nervous, and so this shouldn't be a problem because to take the edge off, I took a half a hit of Valium and it's just kicking in now. So do try to stay awake, and I will too. That's a joke, and thank you for laughing. If you're new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Stick around, we're not a glum lot. I remember 15 years ago, I was at a roundup at the Amari Hotel in Pattaya. And when I was at that Amari Hotel, I was nervous because I only had about 3 months of sobriety and I felt very ill at ease. And they have a very lovely garden setting outside and really nice swimming pools. And I was outside feeling ill at ease, and I had a chat with a black gentleman, and I only mention his race because I don't see very many black individuals around AA in Thailand, and I'd never seen this guy before, and I never saw him since, and maybe some of you might know this guy. But he looked at me, and somehow the conversation came up that I was new. And he said to me, "You'll never have to drink again." And I don't know what I thought, but I don't think I believed him. And you know, that guy was right. You know, I will never ever say that I'll never drink again. I won't make that statement. But I will say I'm not going to drink today, and I'm not going to use today. And if I keep doing the things that I'm doing today, I don't see any reason for me to drink and use again. You know, going back and what it was like, I grew up in a really, really loving family. My parents are very, very decent people. If there is a heaven, my father currently resides there, and my mother will certainly reside there. And there was no violence, there was no abuse, there was no alcoholism. Sorry, over there. Everything was sabai sabai. Krua krua sabai sabai. Anyway. By the time I was 8 or 9, I just started to feel like a freak somehow. Like I just didn't fit in. And it was almost like they passed out this handbook of life, but when they were passing out the handbook of life, somehow they skipped over me. And so about then, when I was 9, 10 years old, the nervous tics started moving in. So I'd blink my eyes and scrub my whole face, and I'd have this ee-ee kind of thing going, you know. And actually, when I'm still a bit uptight, like tonight, for example, those tics can, so if my face starts to distort, you'll know why, but those tics can come back and revisit me. So when I got to high school, that's when the battle really started, because I was a really slight individual. I started high school when I was 13, and a lot of the high school guys were 18, and they had facial hair. I think I had 3 pubic hairs. I mean, it was really awful, you know. And in high school, we had to do PE, and I couldn't do all the things that guys are supposed to be able to do. I threw a football like a girl, forgive me, women. I couldn't catch. I had no hand-eye coordination. I was always the last one picked on any kind of sports team. We had to wrestle, for Christ's sake, you know. And after we were done with that stuff, we had to get naked and take a shower in the locker room. And I was always scared spitless I was going to get an erection while doing that, you know. And the whole thing was just dreadful. And I don't know if these popular culture references will mean anything to you, but I will say them anyway. I was growing up in Central Florida, Redneckville, and all of my peers were listening to Molly Hatchett's Flirting with Disaster, and I was listening to Pink Floyd's Careful with That Axe, Eugene. And so we missed each other. We really, really, really missed each other. And so you know how this story goes. I discovered alcohol, and in my case, alcohol and non-habit-forming marijuana on a regular basis. And you know, some people, they start drinking, and I guess they're rendered an alcoholic immediately. That was not my experience. Drinking in the beginning worked exactly as it is supposed to work. It worked wonderfully well. I enjoyed drinking. It took away all of those feelings of dis-ease, if you will. But I enjoyed it so much and took to it that I kept right on doing it. And, you know, I went to university, and nobody knew what a geek I was in university. And I, cold fact, I lost my virginity the first day of university. It was fabulous. And I'm thinking, this is great, you know. And so there was lots of alcohol, lots of, that was one of the last times though. It started off really well, and then it went downhill from there. That's not why I moved to Thailand, by the way. I just couldn't get laid. Anyway, to get back to the story, university was just a 4-year debauched state of drinking and getting high and scraping by with a very, you know, like a 2.7 average or something like that. And I was out. I was out of school. And I had no earthly clue what to do with my life. And so in order to infuse my life with some kind of interest or drama, I started traveling internationally. And I traveled a lot through Europe as a backpacker in my 20s. And I was a caddy in the European PGA for a while. I lived in East Berlin for a time. It was all interesting stuff, and it all revolved around a whole lot of drinking. I remember when I was in Europe, with the money quickly dwindling, thinking to myself, it's a damn shame that I have to eat, you know? The drinking never, you know, that never occurred to me, but the eating was a problem. If only I didn't have to eat. Anyway, somewhere along the way, I did the cliche thing of throwing some things in my car in Central Florida. My Volvo had like 200,000 miles on it, and somehow I limped all the way to San Francisco. I was 26 years old. I had no idea that San Francisco was so hilly. I don't know how I missed that watching all those episodes of Streets of San Francisco. I had no idea it was so cold. It was frigid. It was awful. It was god-awful. And I was living in my car in the Tenderloin District, and I had about $100. And that's how I showed up in San Francisco. And what happened in San Francisco is this is when my disease really kicked in. This is when I bottomed out and I became a full-fledged alcoholic. I ended up working as a well-educated waiter at high-end restaurants. And I would always go and I would work the lunch shift and then I would work the dinner shift. But as my disease progressed, my life took on the same pattern, and the pattern was exactly like this. I would wake up at about 9:30 in the morning. The San Francisco Chronicle newspaper was always delivered to my doorstep. I would make very, very strong Pete's coffee using a plunger and drink Pete's coffee while smoking non-habit-forming marijuana out of a water pipe. I would then go and work the lunch shift. On the way home from the lunch shift, I would buy a flask of rum. I would have the flask of rum, bottles of Coca-Cola, limes to slice, the bag of Humboldt County marijuana, and the water pipe, and I would commence to drink and get high until it was time to go and work the dinner shift. Then I would pedal my bicycle downtown and I would work the dinner shift. And on the way home, I lived in Potrero Hill. Somewhere along the way, I would have procured a full bottle of Captain Morgan spiced rum. But Potrero Hill, I had to pedal up three massive, massive hills. So the first hill, I would make it. The second, my daughter's not impressed. The second hill, and right there at that second hill was a bar called the Connecticut Yankee. And I really had to stop to get that energy together to make it up that third hill. So I would stop in the Connecticut Yankee, have a few drinks there, and then I would go home. And I would, again, be home probably by about midnight, 12:30 in the morning, and I would have the bottle of rum, the Coca-Cola, the limes, the bag of weed, and I would watch infomercials about the Flobe haircutting device, or you attach it to a vacuum cleaner, and then you run it over. You save a fortune, actually. You save a lot of money. You know. And I loved watching my absolute favorite was watching the religious channel. And not because I was hoping for redemption. No, it was all for shits and giggles. I loved watching, my favorite was Robert Tilton. And Robert Tilton would speak in tongues. And he looked like the Riddler on Batman with his hair whacked back like this. And he would, Koba, Basundra, Basoya, Basoa. I'm trying to speak in English. Basoya, Basoa, Basundra. And the whole thing was to send him a $1,000 vow of faith. And if you send him a $1,000, miracles will occur in your life. And he was praying on the poor. He was praying on the poor. P-R-E-Y-I-N-G on the poor. Forget that in the translation. And so, you know, I would be drunk and high, and I lived in this three-level condo deal, and I was at 656 Missouri, and downstairs was 654 Missouri, Jeff Hofner, and I would call the number and say, yeah, I'm Jeff Hofner, I want to vow $1,000, you know, and I'd give the address, 654 Missouri Street, you know, and like the highlight of my day was watching all the mail come for Jeff Hofner, you know. And we laugh, and I am, in a sense, trying to be funny, and looking back, it is humorous to some degree. However, it's tragic when you consider that, boom, there in my 20s, on that sofa, with the alcohol, with the dope, with the TV, with the isolation. Other people had lives that I perceived were going concerns. People that I went to school with had careers. They had families. They were doing things that I aspired to do myself. I started to hate everyone around me, but I started to hate myself most of all, and I was utterly hopeless. I remember in the midst of that isolation and misery, it occurred to me one day, if you keep living your life like this, and you're lucky enough to live into your 70s, you will have lived your one life on this planet as an active alcoholic. And what a tragic, tragic waste of life that would have been. I'm like, yeah, man, moment of clarity, you know, as I continued smoking and drinking. And then something really, really traumatic happened. I turned 30 sitting in that sofa, and I was like, holy Christ, I'm getting old. That was fast. I didn't have a real job. I didn't have a wife. That was it. I was going to get married. I didn't have a girlfriend, but by God, I'm going to get married, and I'm going to get a real job. But before I do that, I'd better take one last trip around the world. So, you know, I got to tell you, when you hit the backpacking trail at 30, you're a bit of a grandpa, actually, you know? I could pass for 26, and so I, when people asked, I told them I'm 26. That was still more acceptable. I was going to try all of the things I had never tried before, and there weren't many, and I'm not talking about ladyboys. I'm talking about things like, I heard, for example, in northern Thailand, that they had opium dens, and I'd never done opium, and that sounded interesting. I heard that if you went to Nepal, and you know, somebody can confirm this for me if you've been there, I've never made it, but you could go to Nepal and trek in the Himalayas, and they had marijuana growing freely, and it was to me like something out of Sound of Music. Me cavorting along, picking some marijuana while I'm trekking and getting high, you know. I'd never done heroin, and I was looking forward to giving heroin a go as well. And I did. On this trip, which I'm still on, long trip, I did try something I'd never tried before. I tried you. And I'm exceedingly grateful. I never got to the heroin. I never made it to India. I never made it to Nepal. Never made it to those opium dens. But I made it to you. And I stuck around. And I've never been sorry. Many's the time. I woke up hungover. What did I do? What did I say? Who do I have to apologize to? Oh my God! The police were involved. I called this girl that, etc., etc., etc. I have never woken up. God, if only I'd been drunk last night. Never. It's never happened. God, if only I had a hangover. It's never happened. Never, never, never. I was living in Australia. This is what happened. This is kind of what brought me to AA. I was living in Australia, and the trip I took off on, it took me to Tahiti for a few days, Fiji for a couple of weeks, New Zealand for 3 months, and I kind of got bogged down in Australia for a year. And it was Christmas, and I, you know, I have a lovely, lovely family, and so I went back for the Christmas holidays, and I was back there, and you know, they're all working. I'm on holiday from my holiday, and they're all working, and I mean, I've got lots of time on my hands. So my parents live in this beautiful place on a couple of acres of land overlooking a lake with lots of bushes, and I would put up the stereo, and I had a beautiful stereo I bought from some commercial money I'd made when I was in high school, and great stereo, and I'd blast Led Zeppelin and Rolling Stones while I was clipping bushes outside with the rum and getting really, really drunk. And 3 days in a row, I was drunk. And I was really, really angry at myself. And I got a, you know, I didn't write any of this stuff down. So, you know, if it gets a bit convoluted, blame the higher power, not me. But I got to tell you that I never wanted to drink when I went home. That was a major conversation I always had with myself. And I'll tell you the reason why. Because in 1991, I had a brother who turned skeletal and died. And my parents watched one of their sons die of the AIDS virus. And, you know, you're not supposed to lose your children. You're supposed to die before your children. And so I always had this conversation with myself before going home. Mom and Dad have been through enough already. So when you go home, you mind yourself. You don't drink. Okay, got it. I won't drink. Got it. And I love my parents. God, I love my parents. So I'd go home, and I couldn't stick to it. I couldn't stick to it. So all that stuff that you hear about, that's what I was doing. I was hiding bottles. I was pretending I was drinking Coca-Cola when it was a full rum and Coke. The empty bottles being spirited out in the middle of the night. So 3 days in a row, I went to that liquor store, and I bought the flask of rum and clipped the bushes, and I was, you know, drunk, asleep by 2 o'clock in the afternoon and awake, bleary at four. And on the fourth day, I said to myself, you have been drunk 3 days in a row. You are not to go to that liquor store. You were not to have anything to drink. And 10 minutes later, I said, F it, man. I'm going to that liquor store. And I did. And when I was pouring that rum into the glass, I knew I was beat. So it must have been the following day, I partook an action that changed everything in my life. I don't know if it was a God shot, if it was just blind, dumb luck or what, but I looked up Alcoholics Anonymous in the phone book. And the person, and this is in Orlando, Florida, she directed me to a meeting at a Disney hotel for the Disney traveler that really needs a meeting. And so I went down to that meeting, and I got to tell you, today, 17 years later, there is a tweed coat hanging in my closet back in my parents' house. I bought that tweed coat at a St. Vincent de Paul in New Zealand, and it was wintertime and I was there. And in the pocket of that coat, still to this day, is the receipt of that flask of rum that I bought, as well as the hand-scrawled directions to that Friends of Bill W. meeting down at Lake Buena Vista, Walt Disney World. And when I go home to visit, still, I always go to that jacket, and I always pull out that receipt in those directions to remind me of where it all started. So anyway, I went to that meeting, and it was groovy. It was packed. I mean, there were probably this many people there, and it was two speakers, and it was really, really cool. And this guy came and sat next to me. I had hair down to here, and he was this older guy. He was Jewish and from New York. I'm Jewish, so I can say that. He said to me, he was a freak. He said to me, "You look like a free spirit. Are you a free spirit?" And I'm like, "Geez, get away from me." I was thinking. I didn't say that. I was thinking. And he said, "I'm a free spirit. I used to live in Northern Africa. Lots of hash. Country, please." Anyway, one of those, right across in Spain. Morocco, thank you. Senior moment, it's not the Valium. I used to live in Morocco, driving around in camels or donkeys, whatever beast of burden they drive around on, with a big block of hash in my pocket. And I'm like, this guy can hang, he's cool, you know, we can talk, you know. And what I saw in that room was I saw hope. And I wanted that hope. I wanted your hope. I just didn't want to stop drinking and using to get your hope, you know. And so if you're new, this is how I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous to figure it out. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous to figure out how to drink reasonably without having to pay any kind of consequences. And the literature is very clear about this. It talks about the fact that the hope of every alcoholic is one day he or she will be able to drink like his or her fellows without having to pay any of those consequences. And that was me. I thought if I hung out with you guys long enough, nothing too extreme, 2 or 3 months perhaps, then I could have an occasional glass of sherry perhaps, or maybe some Cabernet with my filet mignon, or some Chardonnay with my salmon. It's reasonable. I went home and there was a friend visiting my parents named Lisa, and I said, "Yeah, I've just been to a meeting of AA." And Lisa said, "Those people in AA, they don't drink at all." I remember thinking, that's a trifle radical, you know. That might be their plan, but that's definitely not my plan. And so I went back to Australia, and things were groovy. Things were fine. I was doing okay in Australia. I had an occasional glass of port, not too much. I got high every day, but so what? This was Alcoholics Anonymous. And finally, my relationship was a bore. My visa was expiring, and I had to get the hell out of there immediately. I was at a travel agency looking at all the destinations where I could fly: Jakarta, Singapore, Bali, Bangkok, etc., etc., etc. And those of some people that will know me will tell you I can be a trifle tight with money. And Bangkok was the cheapest one-way plane ticket. And so that's why I came to Bangkok. My daughters owe their existence to the fact that I'm cheap, okay? And so I'm like, all right, I'm going to Bangkok. And so I bought the plane ticket, and it was, the name of the airlines was Olympic Airlines. It was a Greek national carrier, a smoking flight, if you can believe. And I was in the gate area waiting to board, and I was querying this guy. It went from Melbourne to Bangkok, Bangkok to Athens, and most of the flight was filled with Greek people. And I was querying this one young guy in the gate, the holding area there before getting in the plane. He'd been to Bangkok, and I was talking about how much is it, where do you stay, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he was telling me about the general cost and staying Khao San Road, the most affordable, and so on. And then I looked at him, and out of nowhere, I just said, well, I don't drink, so I'll certainly save a lot of money that way. And he said, yeah, as if he really cared, right? So anyway, we're on the plane. And if you've seen that movie, My Great Big Fat Greek Wedding or whatever, that's what the flight was like. All the Greeks are, and they're all just getting hammered on ouzo or whatever it is they drink. If they would have had a lamb, they would have been spit roasting in the aisle, you know. People smoking like crazy. The Greek female flight attendants flirting with all the Greek men, passengers. And I wanted a Coke. And I was in the service industry. I worked in restaurants. I'm very nice and patient with these people. I always say please and thank you. And so I said to the flight attendant who was flirting with the man in the row in front of me, excuse me, but may I please have a Coke? And I swear to goodness, I'm not making this up. She said, you want a Coke? They're over there. Get it yourself. And I said, thank you. And I went, and true to her word, in the galley, on ice, were all these cans of Coke. And in a similar container right next to it was a container with ice filled with beer. And suddenly, that little twist, that mental twist that the book talks about came into my head. And I thought, you know what? You're going to Bangkok. Why not? I drank the beer. Nothing happened. The plane didn't go down in flames. We didn't even hit any turbulence, for crying out loud. That went so well. Let's have another one. So then I thought, well, you know, I've been dabbling in AA for 9 months at this stage. As long as you're drinking, I haven't had any scotch in 9 months. And all there were all these little bottles there they were. So I grabbed two bottles and poured them over ice. And before you knew it, I was hammered. And I was joining the Greeks in the aisles. And I looked down at a young man patiently looking up at me. And of course, you know the punchline. It was the guy that I said, well, you know, I don't drink. So I'll certainly save a lot of money that way. When suddenly, I was hit with waves of nausea. I had to get sick immediately. And this was a packed airplane. Every single bathroom had huge, long queues, except for one bathroom. How fortunate for me, it had no queue at all. So I dived through that door and saw immediately why it had no queue. It was a, forgive me in advance, children cover your ears, it was a shit-infested toilet with shitty toilet paper coming and spilling over the sides. And I got on my knees and I puked my guts out. On August the 4th, 1996, a very, very spiritual time in my life. And I say that in all sincerity, because when I landed in Bangkok, completely demoralized and humiliated, with my mouth tasting really, really bad, I said to myself, you know what? This thing could be serious. And so the very next day, I found myself to Room Rudy, a fabulous meeting with meeting 7 days a week, Room Rudy. And I went to the Room Rudy meeting, and there were two guys there that perceived it was my first meeting in Room Rudy in Bangkok at the Holy Redeemer Church on Soi 5, Room Rudy. Anyway, it's great. Friday night, real coffee. Okay. So anyway, these guys, Michael and Jesus, Tyler. Not Jesus, he wasn't there. Maybe he was. It was a Catholic church. Tyler and Michael. They took me out after the meeting to a place on Patpong, where just a real dive of a place. The curtains have been hanging there since the 1940s. And they had sizzling steaks. And they took me there. And I said to these guys, listen, I smoke dope. and I don't want to talk about it. And they're like, yeah, okay, like, okay, man, we didn't ask, you know? And I got to tell you that when I turned 15 years sober a year and a half ago, Michael, one of the two guys, he took me back there, and we celebrated my birthday in that same place. Curtains were still there, and it was really, really sweet, you know. What happened is, for the first time, I got a home group, and I started going all the time. I was a dabbler in Australia, so who cared if I was getting high? But I started going to the same meetings all the time, all the time, all the time. And so, you know, I started to get to know the people. And it didn't sit well with me that I was getting high. It didn't, and so it was either get it or get out, get it or get out. So August the 4th was the last drink that I had. But my sobriety date is October 21st, 1996. I don't know if it was hash or marijuana, but it was something mind-altering. And I want to be really clear about this, at least for me in my recovery, and I think this is the way this thing is supposed to work. Alcoholics Anonymous is, you know, abstinence from all mind-altering substances. If I take a hit of a joint tomorrow, or if I have a sleeping pill, or if I do take a Valium, I qualify as a newcomer, I've got one day. And so I started going all the time, all the time, all the time, all the time. And I got to tell you, you know, I believe it's the second step, talks about can to believe in a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I took a bit of umbrage at that because that indicated that I was insane. What are you talking about? But I got to tell you, looking back, I was nuts. I was crazy. And I got these resentments so easily. One of my good friends, his name is Jerry. He's crazy. And he's from Belfast. And anytime Jerry says goodbye, he says it like this, good luck. And I remember he said good luck to me and then he left, and I'm like, that bastard said that because he doesn't think I'm going to stay sober. And I was absolutely just, I was so infuriated, you know. There was another guy who was so Catholic, he was more Catholic than the Pope, and I used to antagonize this guy. I used to love to antagonize him, and all I had to do to antagonize this guy is in my share drop something about altar boys and pedophiliac priests. And when I did that, and I did it purposely. And I did that one time, and I got home, and this is back when we had answering machines, and the little red light, ding, 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 on the answering machine, and smoke was smoldering out of the answering machine. I wished I would have saved the cassette. Jake, rah, 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 rah. And, you know, one day it occurred to me something very fundamental about how we do this, and that is that it occurred to me that that guy's always going to have a stick up his ass. And it occurred to me that I'm always going to be an inveterate smartass. And I couldn't turn him into an inveterate smartass, and he couldn't shove a stick up my ass. And so what I really had to do is I had to change the way that I interacted with him. I had to accept him as he was. And so I called him out of the blue. Now, I didn't say, listen, you'll always have a stick up your ass, but I did say, you know what, you're always going to be who you're going to be, and I'm always going to be who I'm going to be. I can't really change you, and you can't really change me, so I have to accept who you are, and I have to change the way that I interact with you, and I promise you, from now on, I'm going to do my best to not bait you, to not antagonize you. And he said, well, you know, I really respect you for calling. He said, no, he didn't. I respect you for calling, and we'll carry on. And it's not like that guy and I started having tea on Sundays or anything like that, but everything was cool after that. And then he ended up in the hospital, and he was really sick, and he was conservative. I'm like, you know, what do you bring conservative fucks anyway? You know, like, do you bring in The Economist? I don't know, Wall Street Journal, I don't know. But I bought him some stuff, and we had meetings in his room. And when my wife had our first child, he came. And so he moved to China, and once I saw him, and he said, hey, tell Poom I said hi. And she remembered. Poom remembered. So I said, hey, so-and-so said hi. And she said, all you AAs are crazy, you know. I went to meetings all the time. I was in a guest house on Khao San Road, and I went to meetings all the time, all the time, all the time. How's my time? Am I okay? Can I go a little bit more, 10 more minutes? Thank you. All right. I went to meetings all the time. I was in Khao San Road for 9 months, and I went to a meeting down at Soy 33, which is now defunct. And on the meeting, I was headed home. I was in bus number 11, headed home. And that bus was packed. And people were holding on like this. And I had an aisle seat, and the person next to me had a window seat. And that person got up to get off the bus. And an Indian man in a turban started to move towards the seat. And I held up my hand, I said, no. And there was this young woman, and I motioned for her to come sit down, and so she did. And she's been sitting next to me now for 17 years. Had I have not gone to that meeting, my parents, my children rather, wouldn't be alive. And I would not have this person in my life. And I'm very grateful and honored that I do. Somewhere along the way, it doesn't say it in the literature, but it talks about not getting involved your first year of recovery. And I want to tell you, I got involved when I was 3 months sober. And I suspect the reason it says that, it says, you do that so you can focus on your recovery. Bullshit. You do that so you don't terrorize somebody else's life, because that's what it was about, man. I did everything I could to get rid of this person, you know? I wanted Nit, Nat, Lek, Song, New. I wanted anyone but Poom. But I got Poom. And no matter what, she wouldn't leave. I couldn't get rid of her. And then Michael, one of those two guys that took me out, he said, you know what? Why don't you have a good look at what you have? Because maybe what you have is really pretty good. And so what I started to do is I started to treat my girlfriend nicely. And it was amazing. The relationship turned around, you know? You could imagine. I was minding my business. Sitting on the sofa, we've been living together 5 years. I was just drinking some coffee on a Sunday morning, chilling out, reading the Bangkok Post. And she walked in and she said, listen, we've been together for 5 years. You either marry me or I'm leaving. Oh my God. I just want some coffee, you know? And I thought to myself, and what I thought to myself is this, are you better with this person in your life or not in your life? And that was a no-brainer. So I said, quote, well, shit, honey, all right, let's get married. And we did. We went back in the United States and we had a big church wedding. And we did the village thing. And I didn't want to get married. I was scared to get married. Well, for all the obvious selfish reasons, the Nit, Lek, New Deal. But the more profound and fundamental reason is that I was absolutely terrified that I was going to trash this person's life. I said to her, I'm an alcoholic, a drug addict, and a sex addict. And you want to marry me? And she said, yes, I do. I must be crazy. And we've been together for coming up in 17 years. We've been married for more than 11 years. If you ask her, I think she'll say that I didn't trash her life. It's been good. One of our very first dates after that bus trip, she said she wanted to practice her English. So we got together and we met at the Grand Palace. And I was new in Thailand, I didn't know anything, but I heard the ladyboys here were incredible, and they were really convincing. So I kept staring at her ass, because I was worried. I was really worried that Poom was a ladyboy. She's not. We're the most indecisive people in the world also. We never thought about having kids. Well, we said we didn't want to have kids. We met when she was 25. Then blink, she's 36. Do you want to have kids? I don't know. I don't know. So finally what we decided to do was just shag and see what happened. And you know what it's like. When you first get together, without being too graphic, it's really passionate and often. But after 11 years, it's definitely not. And you know, other things take over, like reading, you know. It's nice. It's good, you know. You're friendly. But Poom would come up with, like, these 3 days. Now's the time! And nothing ever happened. I mean, it was great. You know, I was getting laid. That was cool. But no kids. So, like, after 5 or 6 months of that, to hell with it, forget it. And so we went back to, you know, sporadically shagging, but just letting nature take its course. And, you know, she was as regular as clockwork. And one day she was a week late, then she was 2 weeks late. So finally I bought that thing, and she peed on it, and there was that plus sign. And you're not supposed to tell anybody. You're not supposed to tell anybody until 3 months. I told everybody, oh my God, she's pregnant. I didn't think I could have a kid. I got mumps in Thailand when I first came here. Too much information, but my right testicle swelled up the size of my fist. It makes her gland swell. And I didn't think I could have kids. And my dad is a gynecologist. He said, that's why you got two. And it worked, man. Those are my kids right there. And I was scared. I thought I was going to trash their life. We almost missed it. My wife and I almost missed our kids. And that's the most important thing I want to say tonight. I almost missed my life. The way I was living my life, you know, like I had 10, 12, 15 lives to burn. So I'll make a complete hash of this one, but I'll do a much better job the next time around. But this is it. And the other thing, too, is I had to get a job. I had to work. You know, we were poor. We were real poor, my wife, and well, she was my girlfriend then. We lived in a room that the bed took up the whole room. And it had an air conditioner, a wall unit, that when you turn it on, it sounded like a cow in labor. And we were so poor, we always ate. It's not like we were destitute poor, but we were so poor that when we would go to sleep at night, I would turn on the air con for 15 or 20 minutes and then turn it off and run a fan on us to save money. And I was at that stage, I didn't have a job, and I didn't have a real job. I was tutoring, teaching English. And when you show up here with hair down to your waist, multinational corporations like Reuters and Shell's not banging in your guest house door, you know. We've got a high-paying job for you. So I was in red buses, you know, going 3.5 baht, non-aircon buses, going from house to house, cheap teaching. And I said to myself, all right, I'm almost done. Stop knocking. I feel like I'm the Johnny Carson show. Stop that tinkling piano. I'm finishing up here, I promise. I just told myself, if you keep doing this and you don't drink, it's all going to work out. But if you drink, all of this stuff is going to be for naught. And I didn't drink. And it all worked out. And this guy, and this is the last thing I'm going to say, this guy named Casey Veer, one of us, he was a teacher here at the top international school, and he laid out step by step what I could do to become a teacher as well and live a comfortable life here. And the first thing was to get a job at a bilingual school, which I did, and then Michigan State sent professors here, and I couldn't afford it. I didn't have the money. And I called my dad, and my dad's a very substantial man, and I was intimidated by him, and he was also very careful with money. And by this time, I'd had 2 years, 3 years of sobriety, so it seemed like I was pretty serious about the sobriety deal. And I said to my father, Dad, I'd like to go back to school and study education, but I don't have the money to do it, and I'm wondering if you'll help me. And there was a pause, and my dad said, of course I'll help you, son. And he bestowed upon me $20,000, and I got a master's degree, and that allows me to support my family very well. My dad died last year of Alzheimer's, but a few summers ago, while he was still pretty cognizant, I was in the backyard talking to my dad, and I said, Dad, that gift you bestowed upon me, it allowed me to become educated, and it allowed me to now take care of my family. And he said, well, you know, son, you'll pass that legacy on. And you'll educate your children. That's what we do. And that's what it's all about. And I have to tell you, I was there when he died. I took care of him. I wiped his ass. I was at my parents' 50th wedding anniversary. I get to be here. I get to be here for life, for the good stuff, the bad stuff, the pain, everything. I get to be present. And that is the most precious, precious, precious gift. I love being sober. Thank you for my sobriety today. Have a fabulous weekend. Kapkumakai.